Welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm David Taffet. I'm here in the studio with Laurent Landis. The late Patty Fink is out of town.
Yeah.
We never listen when she tells us.
Actually, I actually paid attention this time.
Oh, okay.
They went to Louisiana.
I never pay attention. I don't pay attention to anything I say. And when somebody on the internet. No. Okay, Patty will be back next week.
I think she'll be back next week.
So we have a guest.
Yes.
Our guest today is Steve Sprinkle. He is the Director of Field Education, Supervised Ministry, and Professor of Practical Theology. That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful.
At TCU.
It's good to be back.
At Bright Divinity School.
Yes.
At TCU. It's great to have you back. Thank you for coming on.
Happy to do it.
One of the reasons I thought of you is there's this thing coming up next week. It's a big shopping day, and I know you like to shop. That's what it is?
It's Christmas.
That's what it is. I knew it. I knew that there was something there. Now, Laurent, you have a four-year-old.
I have a four-year-old now.
She's going to be five?
She just turned four.
She just turned four.
Not even a week ago.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this must be like her biggest Christmas yet.
Yes, because it's the first one that she's like completely cognizant of what's going on.
And Steve, after all, that's the meaning of the season.
Well, it's a magical time of year.
Yes.
When you can think in sentimental and nostalgic terms about when you were little, believed in Santa Claus, and Rudolph really did have a big red nose,
mm-hmm.
then there's no more magical time for children and for those of us who love them. But, of course, Christmas has a background. And Christmas was not always this way. As a matter of fact,
I thought it was.
Well, it's interesting that.
Yeah, I thought that was what Christmas was about. You just go to the store and buy gifts.
No, I thought back in Jerusalem in the year one, you went to the Cardo, which is actually the oldest shopping mall in the world because it's still there, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Just new stores, not the same ones. And you went shopping and you bought a Christmas tree, no?
Well, if anyone really noticed the birth of a little kid in Bethlehem, they didn't mention it at the time.
Oh, okay.
As a matter of fact, we celebrate the anniversary of the birth of Jesus of Nazareth on December 25, but that was not established anywhere until the middle of the 4th century of the Common Era.
Hmm.
354, that was the very first time that I can find any mention of the celebration of Jesus' birthday in Christian history. Before then, it was not a significant holiday at all.
Well, and, was it a holiday?
It was a holiday. There were holidays around it. For example, there was a Roman holiday called Saturnalia, and that did occur on the 25th of December. But Christianity had the knack for assimilating popular things. And so, as an attempt to continue to Christianize Europe, the ancient church fathers took Saturnalia, its date, baptized it, and voila, you had something like Christmas.
Hmm.
But the Eastern churches, and by that I mean the Greek-speaking churches, celebrated the birth of Jesus on the 6th of January. I don't know whether they call it this where you grew up, but I grew up in North Carolina, and they would talk about the 6th of January or Epiphany as Old Christmas.
Hmm.
Well, that's actually correct, because the first celebration of the birth of Jesus took place in the Eastern Empire in the season we would call Epiphany. It's usually associated with Magi, you know, the astrologers from the East who came bearing gifts to Jesus. But only from the 4th century CE on was Christianity beginning to embrace the notion of a December 25th birth of Jesus.
Hmm.
And that just was calculated because of the winter solstice and because they had a way of calculating, they believed, when Jesus' mother became pregnant and how long it would have taken for her to bring forth a child.
Hmm.
So the conception of Jesus actually was considered before the anniversary of his birth. It was supposed to be somewhere around the 25th to the 28th of March.
Hmm.
So counting from then, December 25 was what they centered it upon. That's right.
And in the, you know, in the real grand scheme of things, does it really matter what date?
No, not at all. I think that the creation of Christmas as a Christian holiday was an expression of a new, vigorous sense of vitality in a church that had recently become the religion of the entire Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. You know, Constantine was the great emperor who established Christianity as the legal religion within his empire in 311.
Mm-hmm.
And the first mention of Christmas takes place in an illuminated document coming from Rome in 354.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense that as the church began to feel its strength, they began to face questions they hadn't faced before, like, when was your Savior born?
And just the idea of a birthday and celebrating a birthday, that's really a very modern thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, I mean, we know when George Washington was born, so that's late 1700s, but actually in Europe, they weren't celebrating birthdays. I know my grandfather didn't know his birthday until he came here when he was 19. He thought he was 17. He thought he was born in November. 2 years later, his mother found his birth certificate and mailed it to him from, then it was Poland, and it's not as part of the Ukraine where he was from. Mailed it to him, and I'm actually 2 years older. And that was a secret he kept until he told me. I was the only one he told just before he died.
Wow.
And he died at the age of 97, but he kept that secret. But mm-hmm. people didn't really know birthday. But what's the difference? We celebrated his birthday on Thanksgiving,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't matter what date. So.
Well, the way that we celebrate Christmas these days
mm-hmm.
is actually a creation of two literary giants. Washington Irving,
mm-hmm.
who was the great American novelist,
mm-hmm.
and Charles Dickens, who's the author of the universally beloved A Christmas Carol,
sure.
where much of our notion of Christmas has actually come from, first in Great Britain and here in the United States. And many of the things that we believe have been in place for centuries are less than three or four generations
mm-hmm.
old.
And this was one, Laurent didn't know this, we were talking before the show.
I don't think a lot of people knew this, but
where did Santa Claus, as we know him, where did Santa Claus in the red suit with the white fur, where did that come from?
Well, of course, it came from a 1935 illustration of Santa Claus for the Coca-Cola Company.
Right, and the red and white, if you think about it, are Coke's colors.
That's yep. Coke's colors.
That's where it came from. Before that, Santa Claus was dressed in brown and in fur.
The original St. Nicholas was actually an early church father who spoke Greek, and he was a jerk. As a matter of fact, he was the patron saint of prisoners and of thieves and vagabonds. So he wasn't particularly the kind of person you want to hang out with.
Hmm.
No jolly old elf there.
So how did the patron saint of prisoners become the symbol of giving?
Through Northern Europe, especially Scandinavia,
mm-hmm.
where Saint Nicholas, who was held in great regard, was associated with older traditions, even older than Christianity,
mm-hmm.
Which had to do with gift-giving and a celebration of the final break in the cycle of winter. Because, you know, in Northern Europe, it gets very, very cold.
Mm-hmm.
It's very dark. So they had something to celebrate at the solstice. And they usually then gave gifts. Also, there was a gift-giving holiday that
but
came
why,
from
why
Southern
that
Europe,
saint?
Too.
Why that saint?
Why that saint? Because he was considered to be the patron saint of those countries.
Oh. Okay, got
you
it.
Know?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you have St. Nicholas, who's a patron saint of Scandinavian countries, like you have
mm-hmm.
St. Patrick, who's mm-hmm. the patron saint of Ireland, that's who you ascribe everything to, right?
Oh. Even if he was also the patron saint of prisoners.
That's right.
Huh.
And even though he was a great big jerk.
Hmm. So, stores staying open 24 hours a day for the last 4 days before Christmas, like Macy's is doing this year.
That's very new.
Really?
Yeah.
It didn't happen back in the 13, 1400s?
When you were a kid?
Oh, no.
Huh.
Me either.
Huh.
No.
So that's a new thing.
That's very new.
When did gift giving actually begin as a Christmas tradition?
Gift giving began as a Christmas tradition really in the mid 19th century. Because the story of the Christmas Carol, which was authored by Charles Dickens, does have a wonderful story of the transformation of a curmudgeon into a delightful person. You remember his name?
Ebenezer Scrooge.
Ebenezer Scrooge. Mm-hmm. And he is famous for his reply when he was greeted at the holiday, "Bah, humbug," you know. But when he went out of his way to purchase Christmas dinner for Bob Cratchit and for Tiny Tim, then that began to set the tone for what happened here. Now, the very first Christmas trees with lights came to this country through the Moravian Church in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and in Lititz, Pennsylvania, and in Winston, it was called Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in Old Salem, because the Moravians set up the very first Christmas trees. But we need to remember that in revolutionary America, while Christmas was celebrated to some extent with gift-giving and feasting in colonies like New York and Virginia and other places around the country, it had been in disrepute for a long time. As a matter of fact, in the New England states, specifically in Massachusetts, it was outlawed for a good portion of the 17th century because they considered it to be a Catholic or Popish holiday. And that's one of my favorite stories about Christmas, that the Massachusetts Bay Colony pilgrims made it illegal to celebrate Christmas in Boston from 1649 to 1681. If you were shown exhibiting the Christmas spirit, you could be fined 5 shillings.
Wow.
And just as an interesting side note historically, while Germans celebrated Christmas and generally threw a big bash in which spirits, alcohol, flowed freely, most American colonists did not. And if you will remember, General George Washington attacked the German Hessians in Trenton, New Jersey, on the 26th of December, right after their big bash that the Germans threw, and everybody was in bed drunk. So,
well, that was just good planning.
That was good planning. But it does reflect a different notion of what the season was for.
For most of us, not for Laurent.
Laurent
will start drinking right after the show, and he will not stop until after the New Year's.
Have Christmas gifts always been wrapped?
I don't believe so. As a matter of fact, the real trend-setting gifts were the gifts presented on Epiphany, traditionally, you know, to the Christ child by the three kings of Orient Are. You remember them? The Magi, who were actually stargazers or astrologers, as best we know. And if you'll remember, there were three gifts, gold, and frankincense, and myrrh.
When I sit on Santa Claus's lap, I always ask for myrrh.
You should have myrrh. That's right. Well, you know, myrrh is actually used in the preparation of corpses for a funeral.
Nice.
Isn't that a nice thing?
Mm-hmm. What is myrrh?
But the myrrh is a secretion, a sap that is secreted from a bush, almost like a tree.
I need some of that.
And it preserved the body, you know, which was an important funeral rite. Death was a very present reality for ancient people.
That's interesting, though. Jesus was Jewish. Jews bury within 24 hours, traditionally. I mean, don't anymore, but traditionally, the burial, if somebody dies in the morning, they're buried by the evening. In a small community like in Israel, that still happens. Why were they preserving the body?
Well, you can begin to see almost immediately that the customs of other people were incorporated into the celebration of this time of year. Okay. These people came from the East. That's one thing you can say about them, these Magi. And they came bearing these gifts. You know, Laurent, you raised the question of were they always wrapped. the gifts have exercised a tremendous influence over Western imagination, because we say that there were three kings who came from the Orient to honor the Christ child born in Bethlehem. But actually, there is no reference made to a number of persons who showed up on that day. Hmm. Only three gifts. There could have been two magi, or there could have been 22.
Well,
it was just the number of gifts that did.
The number of gifts, so yeah, they made it three. So what is frankincense?
Frankincense is an incense that was used. It was associated with prayer and worship. And of course, since this Christ was revered so deeply, even, yes, worshipped by people, then the smoke of the incense was supposed to carry the prayers to the nostrils of God, who found it well-pleasing. And gold, of course, is associated with royalty. So you have these three theological statements, religious statements, being made by that traditional holiday gift-giving. First is that there is a sovereign or a ruler here in the Christ. There is a god here, because you use frankincense for prayer, and myrrh, because of the story of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus later.
So I guess I don't need myrrh. I've been asking Santa Claus for myrrh every year, and I never get myrrh, and I guess I don't need myrrh.
No, because you would be buried the same day.
Really not the same day, but fast
within
enough.
24 hours, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I hope so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well.
That's my belief.
There you go.
Don't need it.
So gift-giving evolved.
Yes.
What did it started with those three gifts. Mm-hmm. So the tradition, really, of gift-giving really does go all the way to the beginning of Christmas.
Yes, it really does. And gift-giving, of course, was carried out by so-called pagan religions or pre-Christian religions in the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. I'm not referring to Judaism at this point. Mm-hmm. You could be the expert on gift-giving in Judaism. But during the Saturnalia, which was a December celebration done in the Roman Empire, there was sort of a topsy-turvy experience held in society, because people who were slaves or servants were honored during that time of year, and the master or the head of the household gave gifts to them. Mm. So gift-giving goes back to that.
Yeah. So the myrrh and the frankincense and the gold didn't come out of the first Neiman's catalog.
They did not, as far as I know.
We're going to talk a little bit more about Christmas. Well, Laron, you are laughing like you expected me to have a normal conversation about this. I invited Steve for a special reason. Our guest is Steve Sprinkle, and our gift is Steve Sprinkle. He is a he's a professor at Bright Divinity School at TCU. Steve, always a pleasure to have you. We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON-FM.
Business owners, tell KNON's listeners about your business. You can put your business or event on KNON. KNON currently has space available to run announcements for you. Tell KNON's listeners about your goods, services, nightclub, concert, or event. Help keep the voice of the people on the air while putting your information on the air. KNON's been named the number one radio station in Dallas by both the Dallas Observer and D Magazine. Put your business with Dallas's number one station. Call now for more information at 214-828-9500, extension 227. Or extension 233. For more information, go to KNON.org and click on the Run Spots on KNON page. It's a great way for your business to support community radio while letting more people know about you.
Don't be a Scrooge. Give the blues to the music lover on your list.
KNON has the perfect CD or LP for you. Texas Blues Radio, Volume 5.
Texas Blues Radio, Volume 5 features acoustic blues, instrumental blues, party songs, Somebody Done Somebody Wrong songs,
Baby Got a Good Thing songs, Six Pack and Devil Back songs,
Gumbo, Jive, T-Bone, and Hip Shaking songs from a fine selection of great Texas blues artists.
So do right by the blues and give some Texas blues this year.
Texas Blues Radio, Volume 5 CD is available at KNON.org, Forever Young Records in Grand Prairie, Record Town in Fort Worth, and in Dallas at Bill's Records and Rewind Music.
Download a copy at cdbaby.com.
The LP is only available at Forever Young Records.
All proceeds are a gift to KNON.
Rita.
And I'm Action Annie.
And I'm Rockin' Robin.
And we're here to tell you that the Magic Time Warp Show has moved to Monday morning, 7 to 9 a.m. on KNON.
Tune in every Monday morning, 7 a.m. for the best 50s music you've ever heard.
Right here on KNON, the voice of the people.
Hanselka, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM, Dallas.
And you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with LaRon Landis. The late Patty Fink will be back with us next week. Steve Sprinkle is our guest. He is a professor of theology at Bright Divinity School. I always want to say TCU, Bright Divinity School, which is at TCU, but it's its own entity. And
we're talking about Christmas.
And we decided to talk about Christmas because it turns out it's next week.
It's next week, yeah. And Steve, you talked a little bit about where the tree came from, but I've always wondered, is there any significance with the Christmas tree?
There certainly is. The Christmas tree, by tradition, is an evergreen. Unlike the trees in my yard, which are oak and maple and lose their leaves in the fall, an evergreen never does. It stays green all year long. And so that tree was considered to be a symbol of eternal life because it stays green.
Or aluminum silver.
Well, aluminum silver, especially if you have one of those nice little twirling lights. Do you remember those?
Right.
That's right, that put multicolors on them. I said before, Laurent, that the Moravians, who were from Eastern Germany and Slovakia, were the ones who brought Christmas trees to the United States. In Great Britain, interestingly enough, the Christmas tree became popular because of what one of the royals did. When Queen Charlotte of Mecklenburg, who was a German queen who actually married into the English royal line, came to Buckingham Palace, she was homesick. And she wanted there to be signs that she was at home here in her new land. And so she was delighted when her husband, the king, had a tree brought into the palace, all decked out in lights, with presents under it. It was a German thing. And when Queen Charlotte of Mecklenburg then popularized it, it took off all over Great Britain and the British colonies. So it's a German thing, you know.
We were talking during the break about gift-giving holidays, and before the break we were talking about was gift-giving traditional at Christmas, and really that goes back to the frankincense, myrrh, and gold. But most people think Hanukkah is the corresponding gift-giving holiday in Judaism, and that tradition dates back to around the time Santa Claus, 1935, maybe before World War II, really probably more after World War II, when the Jewish population really was swelling and really assimilating. And especially in places like Texas, where there wasn't a large Jewish population, the Jewish kids didn't want to feel left out, and so you gave gifts to the kids for Hanukkah. The traditional Jewish gift-giving holiday is actually Purim, which is in March. Mm-hmm. That's the story of Esther and the saving of the Jews in Persia. And that holiday is Christmas and Hanukkah, Christmas and Halloween, because for parties you dress up, and the rabbis back in Talmudic times even ruled that it was okay to cross-dress. It's the only time, because it's Talmudically forbidden to cross-dress. Mm-hmm. However, on Purim, it's okay to dress up, because you dress up as one of the characters in the Purim story. It's okay for all the guys to dress as Queen Esther.
Wow.
Beth Elbanah, the gay Jewish congregation here, has a ball for Purim.
I'm glad to know that. I'm really glad you talked about gift-giving in Judaism.
But that was the traditional gift-giving holiday. So, yeah. And the gifts were small. And even, I remember when I was a kid, because I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood in the 1950s and 60s, it wasn't as important to, oh my God, what are the Jewish kids going to feel? You know, if I went to a school that was half Jewish, half non-Jewish, it didn't matter. The Christian kids got gifts. The Jewish kids did whatever. It just wasn't our holiday much. So that tradition really developed elsewhere, not in the big Jewish communities, but in the smaller Jewish communities around the United States, and spread elsewhere.
So you didn't feel left out?
There was nothing to feel left out of.
But the commercialization of Christmas that all of us know way too much about.
Yeah, that the Jews can take a lot of credit for. Neiman's, Sears, Sanger's, Teich's,
Macy's.
Macy's, all of the Jewish... Yes, we'll take credit for that.
Well, that's a good thing. In our great-grandparents' day, Christmas looked very different. Mm-hmm. I know my great-grandparents used to celebrate Christmas by giving citrus fruit and nuts and candy to the kids. Partly it was what they could afford, but that's what expectations were.
And you know something? For Hanukkah, the traditional Hanukkah gift was Hanukkah gelt. Gelt means money. Yeah. And so I had these elderly spinster aunts, and we'd get a dollar from each of them. But the other Hanukkah gelt is Hanukkah candy. It's actually chocolate wrapped in gold foil that look like coins. And so giving chocolate, but, you know, you give a little bit. So they were, the gifts were just little gifts. They weren't, you know.
So it wasn't this big.
It wasn't this big hysterical.
Like we do with the.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
No.
My father grew up on a farm that grew tobacco in western North Carolina. They didn't have a great deal of anything, but they had a lot of love. Mm-hmm. So he and his brother, my Uncle Woodrow, got a Christmas gift that they never did forget, when their grandmother Wood gave them a chocolate marshmallow Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. Nobody had ever seen anything like that. And Dad said how delighted he was at Christmas. Grandma Wood had actually taken cardboard and had stitched together a little box with a hinged lid, which he remembered all those years. Now, my Uncle Woodrow, who was about 18 months younger than my father, had a pretty voracious appetite. So Dad said that he gobbled his marshmallow chocolate-covered Santa Claus right away. Dad put his under the bed to save it for later. And so 4 days later, he reached under the bed. He was going to enjoy Santa Claus, and something had nibbled the head right off of it.
Oh.
It was Woodrow, of course.
Yeah. Oh, I thought it had melted, and it was just all over the floor.
I thought you were going to say a rat.
Uh-huh. But Dad thought he was a rat.
Mm-hmm.
Dad was smaller than Woodrow, but he said that was the only time he ever succeeded in winning in a fight right after that.
When did it become more popular? And I found this in trying to report for the Dallas Voice, you know, just listing events, when I used to be the listing events person. When did it become more popular to only have Christmas Eve services and not Christmas Day services?
Christmas Eve, of course, has a pretty long tradition, because in Western Christianity, Catholicism celebrated midnight Mass. And the idea was that somehow the stroke of midnight was the time, the darkest hour of the night, when the light of the world, a light that no darkness can extinguish, is rekindled, sort of like the rebirth of the sun, S-U-N. And so the midnight celebration, or the Christmas Eve celebration, became pretty popular. It was only when Christmas actually fell on a Sunday that Protestant churches actually celebrated a Christmas Sunday.
So the daytime service was actually the new innovation.
It was the new innovation.
And the Eve service was the tradition. Now, that definitely comes directly from Judaism, where the day, because we didn't have clocks back in biblical times, the day started at sunset. So at, you know, 8 o'clock or whenever the sun set on Friday night, that's Saturday.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody, the Orthodox like to criticize the Reform for having their services for Shabbat on Friday night. But in truth, it's Saturday on the Jewish calendar. Mm-hmm. So same thing, when you have an Eve service, it is the next day.
It is the next day. That's correct.
Traditionally.
That's right.
It wasn't, you know, the day didn't start at midnight until we had clocks. So,
well, let's take this conversation a little bit of a different direction.
Yeah, sure.
You talked about criticism, and I know you don't feel this way, but maybe you can give some insight to it. Why is there this new notion that there's a war on Christmas?
I'm armed too.
We joke about the commercialization of it, and it really is to the 10th degree. But we know that's really not the true meaning of Christmas. So why do, not all, but a lot of Christians get really upset when they go to a retail store, which is a private business, and they're not saying Merry Christmas, but Happy Holidays or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I'll give two opinions that I have. The first opinion is that the war on Christmas is an expression of a group of people who somehow believe that their traditions are being taken away from them. We've seen that across American life in lots of different ways, not just Christmas. The traditional family has become sort of a symbol or an icon for that, and nostalgia for the way things used to be and the way that they always were, which, of course, you and I know is no more than a socially constructed idea anyway that has evolved through time, and became very popular for certain groups of evangelical or right-wing Protestant Christians. The other part of it, I think, is that, cynically speaking, some of the organizations that have been advocates for right-wing political concerns have used this as a great fundraiser. Mm-hmm. It's been very successful in arousing passions among donors. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when are charitable gifts given more than any other time in the course of a year? This season. That's right. There you go.
I'm thinking synagogue.
This, right. This season.
Really, it's the same thing in Judaism. Yeah. New Year's New Year's Christmas for churches. Sure.
Right. The notion of the war on Christmas, in a little milder version, you can see it on bumper stickers around in Dallas these days. Jesus is the reason for the season. Mm-hmm. Let's keep Christ in Christmas. Well, you can't keep Christ out of Christmas.
And so, you know what? Right. I think some people are just a little bit too sensitive about it. I think a lot of Jewish people are very sensitive about, somebody says Merry Christmas to you. What do you mean? Happy Holidays. Stop it.
Right.
Just stop it. And if somebody says Happy Holidays to you, don't be insulted by that. Nobody meant anything bad when they said Happy Holidays.
Exactly.
I don't get offended. In my office yesterday, we have 15 people. I'm the only Jewish person, and they were bending over backwards. Happy Hanukkah. No, that was over. Mm-hmm. I said, would you just say Merry Christmas?
Right.
It's okay. Yeah. I can have a nice, I can enjoy your holiday.
Right.
And on my holidays, just say Happy Holidays if you don't remember what the holiday is. That works. I appreciate the thought.
Yeah, old coworkers, I no longer work with him, and he was Jehovah's Witness. And I asked him the same thing. Do you get upset when someone says Merry Christmas? I said, oh, of course not.
Nobody said Merry Christmas to you to insult you.
That's right.
I'm insulting Clint, who just walked into the studio, by saying Merry Christmas. But but nobody insults you by saying Happy Holidays.
It's a benevolent remark.
Please.
You're wishing somebody well.
It is a benevolent remark.
Take it in the spirit in which it's given.
And just putting my history hat on for one more moment, Merry Christmas, the greeting, actually originated in popular culture by Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol, because that is the greeting that is exchanged in the streets of London during that period of time.
And like Clint just wrote, because he's not allowed to speak on the air, even though he spends more time in this studio than anybody else, holiday, the word, when you're saying happy holiday, where does the word come from? Holy day.
Certainly. So,
nobody is insulting you with it. Yeah,
nice
of course
job,
it's
Clint.
A good point.
Nice job.
We need to take a break in just a minute, but we're going to change gears a little bit. Mm-hmm. Steve has written a book that he won since he was with us last time. He won the International Silver Medal for the Independent Book Publishers Award for his book.
Congratulations.
Unfinished Lives, right. This was out of thousands of books that were submitted, and how come only second?
Yeah.
Congratulations anyway.
Thank you very much.
No, congratulations. That's amazing.
Seriously.
The book is Unfinished Lives, and it's a book that you cannot sit down and read beginning to end. it is that horrible, and I mean that as a compliment. It is that effectively written. It's stories of people whose lives have been cut short in a hate crime, like Matthew Shepard. And these are even stories that you knew, like Matthew Shepard. You read Steve's account of it, and you're in tears. I mean, it's just there's something new in there. There's something, something extra gut-wrenching. Anyway, the book was just picked up to be published in?
In Korean, in the Korean language, yes.
Which is real interesting. It's the first foreign language that it's been picked up in. How do you go from English to Korean and skip, like, Spanish?
Well, it happens that I've got some good Korean friends. I guess that is one way that it happens. Mm-hmm. But the Republic of Korea, which we call South Korea, actually has a deep interest in the issue of homosexuality and human rights.
But they don't have a whole lot of books on it.
No, they don't. As a matter of fact, the publisher in Korea, a publishing house called Alma Publishing, has let me know that when this translation of my book reaches the Korean public, it will only be the second book ever translated into the Korean language on homosexuality.
Do they have any that were actually written in Korean, or that you don't know?
That I don't know. But
what was the first one, do you know?
The first one is actually the autobiography of a filmmaker in South Korea who himself he's come out as gay.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting. We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. The rest of our show is going to be delightful. In the Christmas spirit, we're going to talk about Unfinished Lives and the Connecticut shootings, because I think Steve has something valuable to say about that. You're listening to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet. I'm here with Laron Landis, and we'll be back with more right after this.
If you are the low-income parent or guardian of children in need of child care, there are programs available in the area that may be just right for you and your kids. Texas Workforce Commission offers solutions for families in need of assistance. Find them on the web at twc.state.tx.us. Click on Programs and Services in the blue bar at the bottom of the page to find out if you are eligible. 211 Texas, a program of the Texas Health and Human Services Commission, also offers child care provider referrals for families seeking subsidized child care. Contact them at 211texas.org or dial 211. If dialing 211 directly doesn't work on your telephone, you can call 877-541-7905.
Hi, this is Candy Markham, and I listen to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. Listen.
And you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet. I'm here in the studio with Laron Landis. Patty Fink will be back with us next week. Steve Sprinkle is with us this week. He is the Director of Field Education, Supervised Ministry, and Professor of Practical Theology. That title is so long, it doesn't fit just on the front of his card. You have to turn the card over to read the rest of it. We were talking about Christmas earlier, and some of the history of Christmas, some of the interesting facts about Christmas. I enjoyed that because I didn't know a lot of that. But Steve wrote a book called Unfinished Lives. Came out about a year and a half ago?
Yes, January
2011. January 2011 is when it came out. And it's now being translated into Korean. I have a feeling once it goes into one language, it'll be translated into several others. It's a wonderful book. It's a very upsetting book. It's a book that you read one piece at a time, and you put it down, and you say, okay, this is great, and I need to get through this book, but I'm not going to do it all in one sitting or in one read-through. Mm-hmm. Unfinished Lives applies so much. Your book is about gay and lesbian,
yes,
and transgender people, yes, whose lives were cut short. Same thing, these kids whose lives were cut short.
That's right.
It's the same upsetting, disgusting, tragic event. How do we even begin to understand it? How did you begin to understand some of these lives that were cut short that you wrote about?
For me, of course, it had to do with a brush with a hate crime that I had personally, in which there was a person who threatened my life because I'm a gay man. Mm-hmm. But hate crime manifests itself in every group we can think of. And it leaves a scar upon not just the victim and the victim's family, but upon everyone who identifies with that person, too.
Laurent, you have a four-year-old kid.
Yes.
When you heard this, the youngest ones that were killed in Connecticut were six, 2 years difference. What did you think? What was going on in your mind? Were you petrified to put Gabrielle in school that day?
Well, she was already in school, and I, you know, of course, the news broke in the middle of the day, and I immediately wanted to go take her from school. But I also had this, there's been this kind of ongoing playful debate between Danny and I about homeschooling. I'm pretty much against it for myself. But, you know, that kind of made me think, well, maybe homeschooling is not such a bad idea.
Safer.
Safer.
Certainly safer.
You know, that was my immediate thought. It just, how could you not choke up when you heard about these kids, children, 5, 6 years old, gunned down?
Now, the discussion about it that has been, that's followed, there were a number of people who had some very thoughtful things to say. Republicans who had supported the Second Amendment and still support the Second Amendment right to bear arms, people who have been NRA supporters in the past, who've been funded by the NRA and don't want to piss them off because they're going to lose a whole lot of money for their next campaign. But they said, you know, this one just, it hit me. My reaction to it was, isn't it interesting that this is the one that hit them? 10 school shootings ago hit me.
Yes.
It didn't take this one. This one, of course, infuriated me, and I was horrified. But it didn't take this one for me. What was it about this one?
This one, I think, is an emotional trigger. I think that it crystallized people's feelings about all the other murders that have taken place in our schools, all of the other mass shootings that have cut people's lives short. But somehow this one, because the victims primarily were 20 little school children who at this time in their lives should be believing in Santa Claus and looking forward to the magic of the days that are to come, who found their lives brutally cut short in moments of horror, and of course their teachers and their principal who tried to defend them. The same thing happened in the hate crime arena around the murder of Matthew Shepard. There had been LGBTQ hate crime victims since time began. Matthew Shepard was by no means the first. But when he died, there was something in that story that gripped the American imagination. And to know hate crimes is to know the story of Matthew Shepard. He becomes the gateway for the others. I think that's what has happened here. These 20 children have become the gateway through which we are finally able to acknowledge our outrage over automatic weapons, assault weapons, and high-volume magazines that hold up to 100 rounds that can be expelled dealing death in just a matter of seconds. Finally, it has come to a tipping point. You have to remember that even the officers of the National Rifle Association have children, too. This is bound
to... So why did they come out with such a stupid statement yesterday?
They did.
I mean, this was... They should have kept their damn mouths shut, is how I felt about it. If they had nothing to add, they were blaming everybody under the sun. I mean, Fox News did a good job, Huckabee and several of their other commentators. It was gay people's fault.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, what an idiot he is. But the NRA was blaming everybody because guns don't kill people. No, people with guns kill people.
Their instincts were right to take down their website and to go dark and silent during the week. That was right. I agree with you. They would have been in better shape today if they had Not said anything.
Because they didn't have good suggestions. They didn't have solid suggestions. Nobody is really interested, not that nobody's interested in taking away people's guns. There are 300 million guns out there. We're not going to be able to do it.
That's right.
We understand we lost. Those people who do not believe in that the right to bear arms to raise a militia means people have the right to have an arsenal of semi-automatic weapons, those of us who believe that the intent of the founders was that able-bodied men should carry a musket because you might need it to defend your territory against the invading British or anybody else who's... That was the intent.
Yeah.
If you want to go to intent, what were they thinking?
Yes, indeed. What were they thinking? Like LaPierre, who comes out and says that their recommendation, a major recommendation, is to put an armed guard in every school in America.
Now, DISD does have DISD police that are patrolling through the schools. I don't know how many police officers are in each school. I don't know if there are actually police officers in every single school at all times. But that's an urban school district. How much is this going to cost? Did anybody, at a time where, you know, it's cut the budget.
Well, their recommendation was actually for two police officers in every public school. And from the estimate that I heard, it will cost $80,000 a year for one police officer.
Yeah.
And how many schools do we have?
And they said it would cost, like, to do that on a national level, two officers in every school, it was like... $3 billion.
Okay, and per year. And the NRA was willing to kick in how much of that money?
Yeah. None of it. Okay. They said that it had to come from the United States government. And they said that it
needed but now to the government can, you know, they want the government to stay out of everything. But now the government can get involved
You're
in this.
You're exactly right, Laurent. And now they want the United States, the federal government, to foot the bill between now and January so when children go back to school... then they'll be protected by someone with a gun. You remember the nice catchphrase they used, the only way to take out a bad guy with a gun is to have a good guy with a gun.
Yeah.
But if that were the case, then what in the world happened here in Texas and Fort Hood, where you have a military reservation?
Yeah, I don't think anybody there had a gun.
No, they didn't. And they certainly were trained in how to use it, but it did not stop
maybe
anything.
That was it. Maybe the people at Fort Hood didn't know how to use a gun.
Maybe so.
Maybe not.
But it didn't stop that massacre.
How many people were killed at that one?
Oh,
a dozen?
Yeah, over a dozen.
Something like that.
Over a dozen.
Over a dozen.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how many were injured?
Yeah. It was around 100.
You know, now, I'm not really making fun of soldiers at Fort Hood.
Certainly.
It happened in a place, I think it was like in the cafeteria or something, where they were not carrying their guns. They were not carrying their weapons. Surprising, nobody had one.
Right.
But... It was on a place, in a place on the base where they were not carrying their guns.
Right.
It's going to happen.
But there have been other instances in recent history in which mass shootings occurred and there were armed persons present. At Columbine, there was an armed police presence or security guard presence in that high school in Littleton, Colorado. And also, you need to remember that there were armed people in Arizona when Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was grievously wounded, a federal judge was killed and a 9-year-old girl. There were people who actually did have firearms present there. It did not deter or stop.
So apparently killing one 9-year-old girl, her life was not worth anything, but 26 to 8-year-olds are. It's interesting. Where do you, where's the balance? I mean, I was outraged that one 9-year-old girl was killed.
For most of us, one life is too many. But, you know, sometimes it takes multiple to get somebody's attention.
Right. We had their attention. And the answer was, oh, we can't have this debate while emotions are running so high and everybody is so excited about this. Are you going to have this debate?
Yeah, and that line of reasoning that says we really can't talk about this because somehow it will desecrate the memories of those who've died so badly is simply a way to defer the conversation about guns.
Yeah.
As long as you're saying something about honoring the memory of these people. Mm-hmm. You don't talk about the weapons.
Here's one thing I don't understand. The James Brady Bill, which regulated and prohibited assault weapons, after Reagan was killed and James Brady, his press secretary, was severely injured, it sunsetted in 2004. Why? How about the Second Amendment? Why didn't that sunset? Mm-mm. You know, we're talking about different guns, different circumstances, different technology. Yeah. Why didn't that sunset?
You know, the Democratic senator from New York, Chuck Schumer, said that people on the left are going to have to recognize that there is such a thing as a Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. Okay, very well. I think we do. But we also recognize the fact that, as President Obama has suggested, we cannot tolerate anymore the routine mass murder of American citizens, and certainly not babies like this.
We can't tolerate people telling us, oh, we can't have a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's that about? Now, here's what I think. Because there were so many people from the center-right who said, you know, I've been an NRA supporter, but this was the one that did it for me, and, you know, maybe there are some things that we can do. I give up, basically.
Right.
I say, okay, let them lead the discussion, but force them to lead the discussion. That's what we can do. We can force them and force their hand that, no, we're not going to do nothing this time. This time we are going to do something. If you need again, this is one of those things that I don't get. If you need a license to drive a car and you have to have it renewed and you have to have your eyes checked, and if you have any other medical things,
you have to have a license just to do somebody's hair. I mean, seriously.
Right.
I mean, something as simple as that.
And it's separate in a nail salon or in a hair salon if they do nails. It's a separate, completely different license.
I
understand.
License.
What is this hysteria about licensing?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't stop anybody, but it sure would help with identifying a particular gun to a particular person, trace it right back to that person.
Which is precisely the position that Ron Reagan takes on this issue. Of course, his father, President Ronald Reagan, was the victim of an assassination attempt and was himself shot. So when Ron Reagan speaks about it, he's got an investment in this issue.
But after his father was shot, the country came together and did something about it. They banned assault weapons. They said nobody needs one of these things. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with hunting. It has nothing to do with sport. It has nothing to do with anything like that. It has to do with killing people. Do you know, I was thrown off of a jury one time when they were doing a voir dire, and they said it was a murder case, and they wanted to know if we would be able to judge the full range of penalties. And I said, well, you know, as a matter of fact, you don't have to go beyond, you could prove to me easily that the person didn't do it. I get that. So I'd have no problem with finding him not guilty. But if you're telling me that he had the gun and it was proven that he had a gun from the minute that gun came into that person's possession, as far as I'm concerned, that's premeditation. Sorry, I don't know another purpose for a gun.
Yeah. I hope that as soon as the days of mourning are accomplished, then the sense of outrage that we feel will keep on burning. I think as we know, there's a certain amount of good anger that is necessary to bring about any social change.
You know, and I agree with you, and I'm hoping that we have a sensible discussion. We can't ban guns. There are just too many of them out there, and the only people who are going to turn them in are law-abiding people who would never do what this piece of garbage.
I think this issue won't be resolved until many different things are done, change. I don't think it's just going to be one answer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's not one thing.
It
isn't
one
thing, but there are certain little steps that every time it's been suggested,
right.
We're out of time. Thank you so much, Steve,
Thank
for being
you, Steve.
With us.
Wonderful to be with
Come
you guys.
Come be with us
again.
Again,
congratulations on your award.
Thank you very much.
And on your book in Korean.
Thank you.
I want to wish everybody who's listening a Merry Christmas, and we'll be back next week with more Lambda Weekly. We'll see you then.